David Landsman, the director of Bear Garden Advisory, who helps banks navigate geopolitical risk. But it's probably better if he introduces himself. David, could you please tell us a little bit about what you do?
Hello. Yes, of course. I was a British diplomat for over 20 years, working in a number of countries, mostly in Europe, a little bit in North Africa as well. And I ended up as British ambassador to Greece before moving on, or perhaps more accurately, back into the corporate world. Spent a few years there, and for the last few years, I've been trying to combine the two experiences by helping people in a number of different kinds of business understand government and understand geopolitics better. Because in my experience, most people, not all, but most people who end up in senior positions in the business world would never have dreamt of going into the civil service or into politics. And they're rather different career paths and different experiences for most people. So trying to bridge that gap and understand the different ways of thinking about things and talking about things is really important to understanding where geopolitical risk impacts on business, particularly in an age where I think everyone now must be able to see very clearly that geopolitical risk is a real thing, and really important to understand it for the success of banks and for the success of all kinds of business.
But if you look at banks in particular, you could argue that much of the risk they face is inherent in being a bank. Say, for example, Silicon Valley Bank mismanaging duration risk. Why should a firm like that, whose business is financial risk management, pay particular attention to geopolitical risk?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, traditionally, geopolitical risk has not been a big part of the role of risk functions in banks, and it hasn't been a big part of bank boards' deliberations. But I think if you see geopolitical risk as an upstream risk, then you can see how, for example, the conflict in Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, or the increasing tensions between the US and China will impact on all sorts of other risks, which banks are more used to examining, what you might call downstream risks, supply chain risks, credit risks, operational risks of all kinds. So if you can begin to understand the geopolitical dimension, you've at least begun to see one of the important causes of the kind of problems that credit risk or supply chain risk or whatever are designed to examine. And if you can catch the problem at an earlier stage, you've got a better chance of dealing with it, pricing it, understanding it correctly.
Someone else I was talking to was saying, well, businesses, it doesn't matter how large and influential they are, have to accept the rules and decisions of sovereign states, which can change on a dime without any consultation. How can banks think about that in fruitful ways?
I think that's a very good question. If you're in any kind of business, you want to try to limit your area of operation to something you're good at and something you understand. The trouble with the geopolitical world or the world of government is it tends to be everywhere and dealing with everything. So it brings at you a whole lot of issues that are not necessarily central to your day-to-day operations. So I think you want to try and have a few tools to hand to try and get a grip of what's going on and try to see where the unexpected might come in. You can't expect to predict exactly what's going on. When I was a diplomat, I wouldn't write very many reports saying, I predict this is what's going to happen in a few months' time or even a few weeks' time. But what I might do is try to look for the triggers. What can you see going on now that might lead you to think that events are going to turn in a certain direction? Can you see in the rhetoric of a government? Can you see in very concrete interests that that government has or that country has that they're likely to move in one direction or another? Is the domestic politics in a difficult position such that a leader might decide that some kind of international adventure is a great distraction from his or her domestic problems. And so I think looking for those triggers, can we break down the situation into a number of different component parts and identify what some of those triggers are? I think that's a really useful way of looking to do what you can't in the end do, which is exactly predict what's going on. But if I see this event going on, if I see this election result, if I see these problems at home, if I see this language being used, if I see this particular resource shortage, water shortage, or whatever going on, what makes a certain outcome more likely? So if you can break it down, looking for triggers. And another one I would say is can you look at separating trends from events? We all get very excited, understandably so, by something that hits the headlines, a terrorist attack or whatever it might be, which of course can be incredibly incredibly serious and damaging. But is that reflecting a trend, or is it just a one-off event? The kind of the equivalent of saying, is this an organized attack by an organized group, or is it a lone wolf? Because they might lead you in very different directions. So looking at what you see going on, is just as you would, as any kind of analyst, if you were, you know, is the price of oil going up because of some kind of trend, or is this a short-term phenomenon? And that's absolutely something you would want to think about. Well, look at geopolitical developments in the same way. Are we looking at the real trends? The real growth of Asia, for example, more important probably than a short-term blip in the performance of a particular Asian economy. So similarly, where are the trends as opposed to where are the distracting, important, urgent, exciting events, but maybe not quite part of a trend you can detect? So I think it's using some of those tools is a good way to get away from the thought, well, all this is totally unpredictable. There's no point in trying to predict it. So there's nothing I can do. Well, there's always something you can do. And simplifying, breaking down into parts is a good way of starting.
And can you give an example of a tricky geopolitical call you've seen that you can discuss publicly?
Personally, I if you like to call it geopolitics, I was ambassador in Greece at the time of the Greek debt crisis. So I arrived in 2009, so saw the early years of the Greek debt crisis. And there was a lot of talk there. Will Greece fall out of the Eurozone, be expelled from the Eurozone? Will, whatever that really means, Germany kick Greece out of the Eurozone? And that seems like a real imponderable. And there seems like some good reasons for thinking it might happen. The German rhetoric was very, very tough. The European rhetoric was quite tough. The numbers were very, very bad for Greece. And it was perfectly reasonable for people to ask, should Greece ever have joined the Eurozone in the first place? On the other hand, I think looking at it quite reasonably, if one country, Greece, had fallen out of the Eurozone, that would have created real questions around the idea that the euro is irreversible. Now, you could argue that, as people did, that Greece was what they call a sui generis case, a special case, particularly kind of bad schoolboy in the Eurozone. But actually, that's a bit unreasonable, because once a country leaves what's supposed to be an inevitable currency union, with huge damage both to the Greek economy and potentially, therefore, for contagion across the zone, that's a big issue. So what was going to happen there? And a lot of people thought that Greece would be kicked out. They looked at the numbers. They said it was inevitable. My personal view was always, no, I didn't think the Greeks would want to be thrown out. The Eurozone means a lot to Greece, far beyond just the numbers, and the numbers were very bad. Actually, the numbers would get much worse for Greece if suddenly they fell out of the Eurozone. A new currency would have devalued very quickly. That wasn't in the interest of anyone with any savings in Greece. But equally for the Eurozone as well, to see a member leave and put at risk the Eurozone would be hugely problematic. And would Germany really have wanted to have its fingerprints on such a risky and perhaps you might say unfair approach? I used to, in my reporting, I used to say this was a little bit like somebody clinging on to the side of a cliff. And if they wanted to commit suicide, then their hands would very easily fall off the cliff, and all you'd have to do is touch it very gently and they'd fall. But if they want to stay, and I was absolutely convinced, as and you know, from my experience in the country, that Greeks really wanted to stay in the Eurozone because they wanted to be part of Europe and they wanted to be involved in all the European institutions, then anyone trying to dislodge them would have had to have applied the boot very hard to that hand clinging onto the side of the cliff. And who would want to do that? So I think it's, look, I mean, how would I sort of extrapolate from that? I would say, look at the interests, not what people say so much as what their interests really are on both sides of any kind of dispute, any kind of situation, and look at the trends, break it down into pieces. What would you have had to have seen coming along to make you think this would really happen? And I never saw anything I thought was going to make it happen, except for that rhetoric. And at the end of the day, just as in business, so in geopolitics, we shouldn't be driven by the rhetoric and by the words. We should look deeper into the facts and into the numbers.
But do you see banks being driven by headlines? Do CEOs open the front page of whatever and think, oh, goodness me, this is happening, I must, am I being unkind to them?
I wouldn't want to be unkind to CEOs. I think sometimes we can see markets going up and down, market sentiment going up and down very quickly in response to something people have read in the papers that day. Now, very often that settles down. Now, the markets weren't wrong to lose confidence in Greece and to some extent in the euro in 2009-2010, because the numbers justified that, and so the market pressure was not in the sense unreasonable. But you do have to distinguish again between trends, real developments, and specific events. And when I remember very well, a curious case. I remember talking to the managing director of a white goods company in Greece at the time, who used to tell me that every time there was a piece of negative rhetoric on the news, his sales would go down. And every time there was a bit of positive rhetoric on the news, his sales would go up. Well, the markets can be quite good at that, but you do have to see past the day-to-day blips and look at the trends. So I think the important thing is, I'm not suggesting that CEOs get driven wild by the odd headline, but I think that the sense that leaders and boards can look at some of these tools so that when they open the paper in the morning, they're thinking a little bit more perhaps about the kind of things they take for granted if we're talking about a specific finance question. But when they're carried into the language of politics and the rhetoric of politics, some simple analytical tools can help you not get knocked off course by what's on the media that day.
Mm. If you were looking to hire or train a bank executive to focus on managing geopolitical risk, what would you want to see? Are there any sort of particular sort of backgrounds or habits of mind? What makes a good geopolitical risk executive?
I think two things I'd say is, one, getting into the detail but looking at the big picture at the same time, because you can't do one without the other. If you don't understand the detail and you don't understand the numbers, if you like, you're going to be sunk, because you're going to just go off on the wrong track. But equally, you've got to look at the big picture. It's not all about the one-off event or the one-off number. And I think the other thing I would say, and this is something I would say is key to being a good diplomat, which is to look at all sides of an issue, but remember who's paying your salary. That's to say, look at all the sides. Don't think that just because somebody looks to be mad or bad, that that's the end of the story and there's no need to try and understand what they're doing, because there's always a need to understand what people are doing, however bad you may think they are and however bad they may be. So look at it from all sides. Try to understand, if you're dealing with, I don't know, US, China, what is what's the US, what's success look like for the US? What does success look like for China at any particular moment? Who are the various players? What are they trying to do? What are their interests? What's driving them? What are the strengths and weaknesses? But of course, and this applies whether you're a diplomat working for a country or an analyst working in a bank, remember who pays your salary. What is your interest ultimately? In a bank, it's your bank and it's your customers. Mm. So how does this affect them? At the end of the day, it doesn't really matter who's right or wrong from that point of view. Your customers' interests, your bank's interests, your country's interests are what ultimately decides the conclusion you'd come to. But before you reach that conclusion, be open-minded and look at all sides of the equation.
Can I ask one last very quick question? It's not a very fair question. What major geopolitical risks do you see coming down the pike that you think banks should be focused on?
Gosh, that is a little bit of an unfair question. I think the obvious ones, in a way, and it all perhaps all flows from top down, is the fact that we are definitely moving into a more multipolar world. We have firmly ended the sort of post-Cold War period with kind of US hegemony, the US as a world policeman. We've seen that now over a number of years. You can't go to Washington and expect to find the answer to every question. And you see that in all sorts of different areas. I mean, the US relationship with the Middle East has changed partly as a result of the changes in the energy world and the reducing dependence on Middle East fossil fuels. It's not gone by any means, but it's reducing. We've seen recently the Chinese apparently broker a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. That's not something we could have imagined seeing a few years ago. We don't know quite what it means yet and certainly what the longer term implications will be. But that's certainly something to change. What it does mean is you've got to look in a lot of different places now to try to understand what's going on. You've certainly got to look in Washington. You've got to look at Beijing. At the same time, whoever you think is supporting the Russians in Ukraine, and some people certainly believe the Chinese are providing more support than has been admitted to, you can't say that Russia is and China are operating entirely in tandem. So you do have to look as well at what's going on with Russia, what the future of Russia is and how Russia is going to play into this. But there are plenty of other countries too. India, most obviously comes to mind, is a very fast growing geopolitically and also large extent economically as a power. And you're not going to be looking for a place. That makes life a lot more complicated. You're playing multidimensional chess in a way that a few years ago you weren't. You were looking essentially at many geopolitical issues as a function of how much the US was prepared to invest in them. Now we're way past that. Some issues are more economic, and you have to look at the role of the European Union as a regulatory superpower, along with the US. So I think the real geopolitical challenge, whichever area in the world you're looking at, whether it's Southeast Asia, whether it's the Middle East, is very much one where we're all going to have to invest more effort in it in years to come, because it's just going to get that much more complicated. And the more complicated it gets and the more players there are, the greater the risk there is for kind of accidents that really matter and that cause big problems. So I think that's a good starting point. So when you've got all these really complicated problems and this multidimensional chess, all the more important to think systematically, break the problems down, use some of the tools, and there are plenty of others, but some of the tools that I mentioned here to begin to make sense of it. Because the worst thing you can do is kind of throw up your hands in horror and say, oh, it's all too difficult. We'll just ignore it and stick to the bits we know. That's missing a massive chunk of upstream risk that we should try to understand and do something about.
Thank you very much indeed for the great talk, David. And yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to find out more about our qualifications, training, and upcoming events, then go to libf.ac.uk. We also have other podcast channels that dive into topics like trade finance, financial advice, fintech, and more. You can find all of them at lrbf.ac.uk/podcasts.